Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Hey everyone, on today's podcast, I am taking you to New York for an intimate tasting with the Zinfandel advocates and producers, better known as Zap, and owner of CorkBuzz, Laura Ferravante. The event was held at CorkBuzz, New York City, and its purpose was to help explore Zinfandel's place on the world stage of wine, preserving legendary Zinfandel vineyards in California, and why Zinfandel is, according to those passionate about the variety, one of the most versatile food wines out there. I hope you enjoy. Sláinte!
Wanted to recognize your great work in pulling this together, and thank you, and also thank you. And I wanted to kickstart the conversation, if I might. What defines a legend? So, having undertaken the exploration of Zinfandel for over 30 years, Zap offers the following for consideration. Defining a legend can be a difficult feat, but there is one thing that is for sure. Legends are timeless. Their contributions will long outlive them, and they are immortalized for greatness. Legends can create a long-lasting effect, and we honor them. So we invite you to enter the discussion in what defines a legend. Laura, take it away. Thank you again.
Thank you. So good morning to everyone. If you don't know me already, I'm Laura Manick. I'm the owner of CorkBuzz, and I'm a master sommelier. As far as Zap is concerned, I am not a producer of Zinfandel, but I am an advocate. I often say that Zinfandel is one of my favorite grapes, which might sound a little crazy because so many of our colleagues, sommeliers, like, oh no, Pinot Noir is my favorite grape. But the reason that I think Zinfandel is my favorite grape is because it is so versatile. And I think you're going to see in this tasting that there's so many different faces or expressions of Zinfandel. And so I'm really pleased to show you all of these wines and to have an accomplished and esteemed panel here. We're going to start at my far right, and I'm going to introduce David Abadia. He's the president of Ridge Vineyard, so I've long been a fan of Ridge Wines, an incredible, legendary winery. I think David said it perfectly. His job right now is to ensure that the next 50 years at Ridge continue the same way as the previous 50 years. So your role as the president, you pretty much do everything at Ridge. But prior to Ridge, David worked for 6 years with South Fork Group. He's the vice president in charge of Canada and Latin America. He worked for Randall Graham, another great winemaker, the vice president of sales and marketing at Bobby June. And he was instrumental in taking the winery to screw cap closures. So we're really pleased to have you here and excited to taste the wines of Ridge. And next on my immediate right is Nicole Salengo. She's a winemaker at Berryessa Gap. This is very exciting to talk about these wines from Yolo County, and maybe some of the audience has not even heard of where Yolo County is. So I'm very excited to show these elegant and restrained side of Zinfandel, and I'll let you talk a little bit about that after. So Nicole was UC Davis after college. She earned winemaking certificate and viticulture and enology. She's really passionate about Yolo County and the regional terroir, which I'm excited to hear more about. So we have that style of wine. And then on my left, we have Kim Stair Wallace. She's Dry Creek Vineyard. She's the president and owner. And so her family started Dry Creek Vineyards. And so that was, I have it in
1972.
See, 1972. And so currently you're running the winery. You're the president. And so we'll talk a little bit about Dry Creek Vineyards in a bit. Very pleased to have you here. And then last but not least is Aaron Piatter. He's a winemaker for all of E&J Gallo Winery with a premium winemaking team. And so he's going to talk to us a little bit about the wines as well. And I think we'll kick it off by saying, do you guys have anything to say to start about what do you think is what does Zinfandel mean in our, as far as wine goes? Like, what should a classic Zinfandel taste like? Which I would imagine we're all going to have some different answers. And then we'll talk a little bit about like the legendary vineyards in California. And so yeah, maybe we can just kick it off and talk about Zin, what it means to us, or why we think it's important. Sure. I will say one thing before I turn it over to you guys. Zinfandel is so versatile with food. And I think often we think they're just big, intense, high alcohol wines, which we can see some of those jammy, juicy, big qualities in some of our Zins, but we also have this light, sweet and sour aromas and tartness and bright acidity and elegance in all of your guys' wines up here. And so I find, you know, anything that you can imagine has a sweet and sour, sometimes we of course can do barbecue, we can do richer fish dishes, which I think it's been amazing to see with like trout and salmon, things that have like an inherent sweetness to them. Of course, you know, you can have some styles that go well with chocolate, and you can do some, you know, stews and braises, burgers. So there's so many different things that I think that's one of the reasons. And unfortunately, sometimes Zinfandel, the legendary vineyards, which I think we'll talk about in a minute, they're being ripped up. So you have these old vines and these young vines throughout the state of California, and people are replacing them with Cabernet. Because maybe it's what the consumer wants, but I think it's really important for us to keep the Zinfandel vines in California because of the fact that they represent, you know, our kind of like our California American heritage, if you will. So, all right, I've said enough for now. I will definitely guide us, but Dave, maybe you want to say a few words.
Sure. Yeah, Zinfandel, it's referred to as California's native grape, but I really think of it more as, like a lot of us are, is sort of the immigrant that came to the States and did well, because it's not really native, it did come from Europe, and that's where its home really is, but it's done much better in California than it's done anywhere else, so it sort of represents the American dream in a lot of ways. The idea of what makes great Zinfandel, so now sort of putting more of the rich hat on, we really feel that great wines come from great vineyards and great vineyard sites, be it Bordeaux or Burgundy or single vineyard Champagne. It's really the vineyard site, and where you have this combination of varietal mix and soil and climate, and it all comes together, and that enables you as a winemaker to make a great wine, rather than starting with an inferior vineyard and having to insert yourself and really manipulate wine to make a great wine. So Zinfandel came and planted throughout California. You'll be able to tell me that it's in a lot of counties throughout California. It's probably the most widespread grape in the state in terms of planting. But that's not to say everywhere it's planted is making great wine. But I think that the trick in terms of great Zinfandel is finding those locations where it performs the best, where you can, as a winemaker, step aside and let the wines make themselves. You know, at Ridge, we've been at it a long time. We've made Zinfandel from probably nearly 100 different vineyards throughout the state. But through that time, we've whittled it down to those sites that really we feel are great, where you have this consistency of style. Every year it tastes like Geyserville. And there's a consistency of quality that, you know, 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 vintages, you're making great wines in that site. So I think that's really the trick, is trying to find those sites. Old Vines plays a huge role in that as well, in terms of the quality of the wines, and being able to preserve those vineyards for future generations. And that's what, where the greatness lies, and that's what we need to really work individually as a winery and lose out to protect those sites.
Thank you, and I love what you said about the American dream, because I think that it is important to talk about the heritage of Zinfandel. And actually, this is a great segue for Nicole, because I noticed on the label that you guys produce, you have a mention of Primitivo.
Yes.
And so maybe we'll just talk a little bit. You can explain what you think is Great Zin and Great Zin Vineyards, and maybe talk a little bit about Pulo County, where it is, and why maybe you're referencing Primitivo on the label.
Sure. Well, I came into wine production from a wine purchasing background. So I worked at a small wine shop in Davis, California. So I would taste a lot of premium wines, and originally, you know, like 15, 17 years ago, people were looking for Zinfandel, and I didn't think I really liked it in my early 20s. It tended to be really concentrated, higher alcohol. I could just have a glass of it, and, you know, it's difficult to have more because of that high alcohol concentration. So once I started working in production and came to this vineyard site, I realized very quickly it is all about the site. And the family that I work for currently, they run a rootstock company, so that's the plant material to start a vineyard. They have run that since the 60s, and they have a great reputation for quality plant material. So that's why they selected Primitivo. They did some trials in Yolo County. So Yolo County is at the edge of the Central Valley, just east of Napa. And it's in our vineyard site, so it's a sticker site in the foothills of the coastal range. And it's the only Zinfandel that I'm aware of planted within, I don't know, like a 30-mile radius. So frankly, it's my favorite variety. Red variety that we are creating at Barrios Agape, and we're working with 12 red varieties. And it was really surprising to me, but it is the wine that I need to work with the least, and yet they need to work with the most in the vineyard. So I do think the Primitivo that they selected, that was planted in 2000, so we're working with younger vines. And I personally am finding, you know, coming up on my 7th harvest with Barrios Agape, the vineyard's coming into its prime. We're not having to drop fruit as much, and I think that really speaks to the quality of the wine. The older the vines get, the better I'm noticing the quality of the resulting wine that I'm making is getting. Did I answer?
Yeah, that's
all right.
And so maybe we'll talk a little bit about that would be a good segue. And so we're kind of representing all the different regions of Great Zinfandel, and maybe you want to talk a little bit about what Zinfandel is to you and what you're trying to achieve, or what you think you guys, what's your style?
And I have 5 hours to do that?
Yes.
Gosh, well, first of all, Zinfandel is the perfect breakfast wine.
Yes.
Well, so Nicole said they've had 7th harvest. We're coming up on our 47th harvest. So my family has been in the Dry Fruit Valley since 1972. We were the first winery there after Prohibition. And thankfully, my father made Zinfandel. And, you know, I think Dry Creek Valley, which is one of, gosh, I think there are now 18 AVAs in Sonoma County. And we're at the northern end of Sonoma County. But Dry Creek Valley is considered kind of the cosmic epicenter of Zinfandel in California, if you will. And maybe my colleagues would argue that. But Zinfandel was brought to Dry Creek Valley in the late 1800s by the Italians that settled there. And my family has had the great fortune of working with some extraordinary vineyards, and it is absolutely true what both David and Nicole said, that it all starts in the vineyard. The two wines that I brought that I'll share with you couldn't be more different, but they also reflect very exciting vineyards. One is extremely, extremely old, and one is not young, not old, but has the DNA from the old vine budwood. So I think, you know, the Zinfandel vineyards that we have, we can thank our Italian forefathers. You know, one, keep in mind, many of these Zinfandel vineyards are field plants, so they were planted with a variety, a mishmash of grapes. And in some cases, we don't even know of all of the different grapes, but, you know, it could be Trousseau Brie and Mourvèdre all kinds of other things that are, you know, varietals that we don't even, you know, that aren't commonplace these days. So, Zinfandel is definitely my favorite wine, and I was raised on Zinfandel. It's the wine that I drink every day, and I agree with you, Laura. I think it is one of the most versatile wines in the world, to be honest. It ties in perfectly with American cuisine. one of the things I think that's very important for Zinfandel, and certainly any world-class producer of Zinfandel, is balance. So Zinfandel is a, it's one of the, if you ask, Aaron, maybe you too, but my winemaker constantly tells me, and he's had, you know, decades of experience, that Zinfandel is one of the most challenging grapes, and almost sort of like Pinot Noir. And one of the reasons why is it's an uneven ripening grape cluster. So in harvest, or in, you know, in the fall during harvest, oftentimes you'll have different colored berries. You'll have green berries within the purple berries, and you know, the cluster don't all ripen at the same time. So it really takes a seasoned winemaker to know when to make those picking decisions. And so sometimes when you get into these very overripe, high alcohol, jammy style Zinfandel that have kind of dominated the market maybe in the last 10, 12 years, that are thankfully starting to go away, I think part of that is some, you know, somewhat inexperienced picking decisions. But in terms of, you know, my approach and my philosophy of Zinfandel is that it has to showcase balance. It has to have absolutely those unique cranberry, blackberry, boysenberry fruit tones, but it also has to have that beautiful spice that you only get from Zinfandel, whether it's cardamom, nutmeg, cinnamon, or black pepper, white pepper. And then acidity. You have to have the right amount of acidity. So overall, the balance is what we're looking for, whether it's a really bold, you know, old vine style, or perhaps something a little more feminine. Balance is really what's the key, and Zinfandel, I think, frankly, can showcase that better than many varieties, certainly many red varieties. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Oh, that's amazing.
let's see. I guess I'll stop there.
and we'll go back to some of these points. Like, we'll talk about more on dosage and like alcohol and uneven ripening and where that might happen, how we can like maybe use that natural uneven ripening to achieve the different styles. I'm curious about that, but maybe Aaron, you want to talk a little bit about what your thoughts are about Zin and what makes a legacy vineyard? And
sure. Yeah, first of all, I'm going to answer Rebecca, since she asked you guys to think about what is legend. It's the ricotta that's in front of you.
Oh, that's my grandma's recipe for ricotta.
It's a great find. So I'm in my 26th year. I was born and raised in the town of Sonoma. Kind of born and raised where Zinfandel emerged. I'm lucky enough to work with a vineyard called Monterosa. So as Nicole mentioned, vines get better as they get older. It's a 126-year-old vineyard that's still quite active in production. Luckily, Zinfandel for us is exempt from all forms of efficiency and farming metrics and yield and all that sort of thing that were with Zinfandel a long time ago. In modern trellising, modern farming of grapes, you tend to look at breaker, quality, style, all that sort of thing. It's got capabilities as well. And Zinfandel, those old vines up there, they're gnarly, they're crazy looking, they branch out all over the place, they're a mess, and they are low yielding, but no one's going to touch them. There's not a finance person who says that's not yielding the proper tonnage. It's got to come out of the ground. It's fantastic. So in terms of legacy, as Kim mentioned, plantings that are there for well over 100 years. They're just magical. We have two locations. We have the eastern hills of the Sonoma Valley, which is where Monterosa was situated, and then we also run the Dry Creek Valley. So the winery I work at, Brad Brothers, is one of the oldest vineyards and areas of Dry Creek. So we're neighbors across the street. Zinfandel to me is fantastic to make. It's fun. You can kind of imprint your style on it. And making Cab and all sorts of other varieties that I have in the past, Zin lets you have the freedom to make something energetic and vibrant and in a sense safe, or you can make something really juicy and generous, or you can push it to the limit and just know you are going to be on your heels all the entire fermentation. You're going to be on defensive mode. And those styles are in bottles of wine, which you guys have seen. I think the latter are the high alcohol, really big, intense Zin. So that's a choice. When you're looking at that cluster, as Kim mentioned, with the, we call it chicks and hens, there's big berries, little berries, and little ones dehydrated, you know, damn near raisins, and the perfect ones are kind of dimpled and mid-sized. The big ones are more cranberry, raspberry, have more acid. The little shriveled ones are more of your kind of juicy, jammy style, and those little raisins are going to be buggers that are going to make fermentation tricky, and you know they're in there doing their thing. So stylistically, with Merlot, Cabernet, Pinot, for that you wouldn't pick something early, very early stylistically, because of things you don't want. It's full of greens, or the tannins aren't right, or there's too much forest floor, or earthy character, or even florals, right? Not enough generosity in the fruit. So you tend to have this sort of centric mind when picking those varieties. You want the texture to soften. And so within, texture's there. If you pick early, you're going to have that cranberry, raspberry, florals, if you will. You let it go a little more, you get a darker red spectrum, and then you go to the end, and we thought we picked in the middle. By the time it soaks up, we realize we're closer to the end than the middle. But then you can choose that whole spectrum. And stylistically, we brought two wines that we made that are right in the middle of the spectrum, and then one very close to the end of the spectrum. That's very representative of the sites, but all three of my colleagues have mentioned, if you want barrels, you can buy the same barrels as us. Just get out your credit card, call Cooper, you can have whatever barrel you want. If you want tanks, you can have a fancy tank in your backyard if you want, no deal. All the equipment, that's open game. What people do have that makes them unique and special are the sites that they use. And Zin is very, very unique in its site. I think we'll see as we go through fruit profile, acid levels, spiciness, earthiness, all those things are very distinct to the site. So I think Zin speaks to terroir fantastically. And we can say with great pride, even as neighbors, there's little nuances on the, you know, more hillside than there is on the more fertile valley floor of Dry Creek Valley. Just within Dry Creek itself, there's amazing diversity. So it's going to be fun to taste through these.
We talked just about these two wines, like your feelings on them, and maybe a little bit more about the vineyard site.
I'll talk about the vineyard site. So I talked about how the Cobble Ranch, our 60-acre site, is planted in the foothills of the coastal range. The site was planted, the Primitivo selection of Zinfandel was planted in 2000, and it's kind of in these rolling hills, only at about 100 to 125 feet elevation, so not at elevation, warm climate, as I mentioned. But we have, you know, our namesake, Berryessa Gap, is named after a landmark in the mountains, which is literally a gap in the coastal range to the west of our vineyard. And behind that, further to the west, is Lake Berryessa. So we have these warm days, 110 degrees is not abnormal, but at night, we get really strong prevailing winds from the west. And a unique thing about our vineyard site. I live like a mile south of the vineyard, and I don't get those winds at my house. So Winters is known for a lot, has a lot of microclimates historically. It's a big ag community. And so I believe, you know, the warm days, you get these nice bright red fruit flavors, and then you cool down at night, a lot of your grapes can rest and develop better flavors. The Primitivo is the first red variety to be harvested every year, but that's partially because I pick it early. I'm all about acidity. You may know in a warmer climate, it's more challenging to preserve natural acidity in wine, so my goal is always to try to pick the Primitivo around 25 Brix. As Aaron mentioned, Zin is notorious for creeping up in the fermenter and sugar. So I try to pick before we start getting any raisins. That's my goal. So I am not afraid of green berries, pink berries. I will admit, recently purchased an optical sorter, but even before we were optically sorting, the optical sorter is more to get the raisins out. I do not sort out like the pink and green berries. And that's probably has something to do with the lighter color here. Another thing is I really try hard to keep all of the wines that I'm making 100% true to the variety for a number of reasons. People aren't familiar with Yolo County. B, not everyone is familiar with Primitivo, so I'm just trying to focus on that so people become more familiar with our area. 16, beautiful harvest. Frankly, the sugar got a little higher than I wanted. So 1.5-ton fermentation bins. For the 16 harvests, it was just hand punch down 3 times a day. I do a cold soak for 48 hours at 55 degrees. I do inoculate. It's just, I do have a Zinfandel yeast survey light from the port. I also inoculate for malolactic. In 16 is the first year I tried a co-inoculation. The idea is to just get the wine through all, you know, all of its fermentation as quickly as possible, because what I really love about our Zinfandel is that fresh aspect, that ripe acidity. So as wine ages, as we all know, that dissipates. So I really want to preserve that. And the 16, I stopped. We press in a 5-ton basket press, very traditional, but I stopped the press early. So I really am nervous about the sugar going up in the press as well. So I'm always looking out for that. After the fermentation, after the pressing, we age. You know, my philosophy on barrel regimen has to do with the weight of the wine. So these wines aren't heavy. They're all aged in twice used oak barrels, all French. I have probably about 10 different coopers that I really like, and there are certain ones that I prefer with Zinfandel. And then, did we talk about 17 as well?
Sure.
I should compare them.
Yeah, I would love that too. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and maybe somebody at any point, you guys can jump in, is talking about alcohol in Zinfandel, because I think often, maybe more us as a trade, when we think of them, we're like, oh, they're too high in alcohol. And I want to point out that these ones are about 14.6, 14.8, the first two. And most of Barolo these days are at least that amount. So when we think about saying, you know, oh, Zinfandel is so rich and so big, or it has so much alcohol, many of the world's finest, most age-worthy wines are creeping up in alcohol. I don't think that even though these are 14, you feel them at all. And so I think that it's a really good thing. When you have ripeness of fruit, you have elegant acid, I think that the alcohol levels can be pushed. I mean, that's not high by any means. But like even when you see things like 16 alcohol, if the wine is well crafted and it has the structure to match, it doesn't necessarily feel like that. It's a really important topic of thinking about alcohol and letting the wine stretch. Like, would you feel that these are that high in alcohol? Does anybody feel like a burn or any? No, right? I also found like with the 16, you get like a little bit of, like we said, like a darker, more ruby, but it's still light in color. And then when you go to the 17, that's when you see like how light and pale and thin skinned and smells a little bit more like a tartness and a more sour, with the still like youthful, gemmy qualities, which I really enjoy a lot.
And I think Kim spoke about the balance. So I find Zinfandel can withstand a little higher alcohol. There's a lot of flavors, lots of acids. I have a little suspicion that there's some other weird sugars that we don't monitor for in winemaking that occur in Zinfandel. But so for talking about the 17, it was a much hotter year in August. We picked our Primitivo at the end of August, right around my birthday. I tried to get right on my birthday up here, but. So yeah, 17 was a hot year. This wine really reflects it. I tried an experiment with a submerged cap method. So I learned about this. I've heard about other winemakers trying it with Pinot Noir and Zinfandel. So I thought I'd try it. So we created these stainless steel screens that we put on our fermenters. And instead of punching down, we just did a reductive fermentation. And we 75% of the wine that you're tasting, it was not even mixed during the fermentation. So that also has to do with the lighter color. But it was just, I like to do a lot of experimentation. I'm still trying to figure out our vineyard and what works best for all of our varieties. And I am really happy with the way it turned out in 17. This is more of what I'm trying to achieve. I am looking for an elegance and a very approachable and food-friendly wine, but I also like to chill artisan. So I've spent some time in Europe, and all of my favorite, I really like more lighter style reds. So they tend to chill in there, so I like to do that on our wine range.
I was just about to say, like, this is the type of zin that you can just serve as aperitif, and you can have a slightly chilled. You can imagine it goes well as like lighter fare, and so that's really great. Okay, so maybe David, I'm sure everybody wants to hear a little bit more about Geyserville and about what it brings and how they differ, and maybe even talking about blending zins, since your wines are often a blend.
Yeah, absolutely. So we were asked to show two Zinfandels that we think are examples of classic zins. So we make probably on average about 15 different zins every year, so there's an array to choose from, but clearly, that we feel these are our two most classic Zinfandels. And they're great to show side by side because they're only about 2 miles apart, but show tremendous differences, and they really reflect the unique terroirs of the two sites. These are both old vine vineyards lived in Geyserville pre-Prohibition. Geyserville, the old patch was planted about 1885, so they clearly the oldest vines we worked with at Geyserville. And Libby Springs' old patch was planted in 1901, and then a second lot in 1910. So these are kind of both very old vine vineyards. And I always like to say that they need to be great vineyards. They survived World War I, they survived Prohibition, they survived World War II. They survived a lot of things, but they're still on the ground. So I think that's a testament to the quality, because there was multiple opportunities to rip these vines out of the ground, but they're still there today. So that alone, I think, is a testament to the quality of these old vine sites. They're both field blends. And, you know, we talk about this concept of field blends, but this was no accident. These farmers who planted these vineyards, you know, over 100 years ago, clearly had a plan in mind when they put the vineyards in. They loved Zinfandel. They came to California around 1850. It set a good crop. They loved the fruity nature of the wine. It was flexible. They could make rosé. They could make fortified wine. They could make table wine from it, different styles, so it was flexible in that way. And it was really well-suited. And like Kim said, we really feel like ground zero for Zinfandel in the world is sort of this Dry Creek Alexander Valley area. This is the best Zinfandel comes from this area because the climate is perfectly suited for the grape. But these farmers, when they planted, they realized the benefits of Zin, but also its shortcomings. It's thin skin, similar to Pinot, not deep in color, not deep in tannin. And we wanted to compensate for that. And also in this warm climate, they can become sub-acid, that they needed an acid punch. So the Petit Sauvage was interplanted for the color of tannin and Carignan, which in very warm climates in South France and the Central Valley of California still maintains its acidity, provided the acid punch for these plants. So those were the three key varietals that were planted together. But we've gone out and mapped both of these guys are going to vineyards. There are 22 varieties that are planted at Geyserville, and there are 18 distinct varieties planted at Wood Springs. So, including white varieties like Palomino and Riesling, Alicante, and other Tinto varieties that are in the field. And we thought it was totally random, but when we mapped Wood Springs, we actually saw that in every fourth vine and every fourth row that lived was planted to Alicante. So there's an actual grid that was put in. So although it appears random as you walk through the vineyard, you can actually map it because there was a method to the madness. And we really feel that these mixed field blends are the key to quality. For years at Ridge, even as we replanted or planted new vineyards, we planted solid boxes in Verdell, solid boxes in Teague and Carignan, and then blended afterwards. But it was taking upwards of 10 years for these blocks to make it into our primary blends to be able to Geyserville. Then we experimented with recreating these old vine blends in and planting in the same fashion as they were planted over 100 years ago, and immediately these new plantings will go into the top line. So there's something magical about the co-fermentation of what is in all these other varieties. There's something magical about the combination, and that you can't recreate from blending afterwards. They have to be grown together and co-fermented to create these great wines. So in terms of the Geiserville, which is the wine number 3, and that's from the 17 vintage, the soil type is different here. This is in the plains of the Russian River. It's in an old riverbed. There's a lens of this rocky soil that Geiserville is growing on, which is distinctive from all the soil around it. As we get closer to the Russian River, it gets heavier and wetter the soil, which means Zinfandel does not like. Cabernet is grown there if it survives, but Zinfandel does not really perform well in that. But in this lens, it produces this unbelievable wine. With the blend here always nearing 20% Sherry. So most of the time it's not even 75% Zinfandel in the Geiserville. So Carignan is the second dawn variety, then Petit Sirah, then Alicante, and then Vitaro. And then which produces a wine with a lot of acidity because the Carignan is up, it's red fruit, it's fresh, and very light. We never have to acidify Geiserville, the natural acidity from the vineyard and the soil that allows us to make the wine naturally. We never have to monkey with wine at all. It comes in and make it pretty much straight up. And then the Little Springs, different soil type. This is in Dry Creek Valley, on the other side of 101 in Alexander Valley, where Geiserville is. Rolling hills, heavier clay loam soils. And here, Petit Sirah is the second variety. So the combination of the heavier soils and more Petit Sirah complementing the Zin. This is a darker wine, more broad-shouldered, more tannic, and more of these grown flavors in the wine I find. So more of that earthy meatiness. It's not so much a fruit-driven wine like the Geiserville. It's more of these other tertiary, secondary flavors that drive the wine with the strains. And we were talking about picking decisions. So with a mixed yield like that with the Geiserville, the complexity of picking decision is just amplified. So not only are you dealing with a finicky Zinfandel out there with uneven ripening and clusters, now you're dealing with, you know, the Carignan not ripening slower than the Zinfandel, and the Petit Sirah slower than that. So how do you decide when to pick that vineyard, which just becomes really complicated. But we're shooting for that sort of 23, 24 bricks kind of target for picking decisions. But what you end up with is you end up with some grapes slightly overripe, some perfectly ripe, and some slightly underripe, which just, in the end, adds to the complexity of the wine with the different ripening levels with the mixed yield. So that just adds another layer of complexity. We shoot for, you know, alcohol levels in the low to mid 14s for our Zinfandels. Producing so many Zins, you know, 15, 16 Zins a year, that if we feel like we're up at 15 and a half alcohol, you lose the terroir. The wine starts to taste the same. Lidden tastes like Geiserville, that tastes like Pagani, which tastes like Monzo. And that's really the beats of the purpose. We really are trying to, as winemakers, transmit the personalities of these unique sites into the bottle. With Zinfandel, which is a great transmitter of terroir, but yet that's really deflated if you're communicating too right. You just lose that sense of place without all those. It gets you hot with us. So I think I probably said it now.
I love seeing the different styles of both Litten and Geiserville side by side. And I think, I mean, I wrote the same notes, like, in the Litten, you have more restrained, deeper tannins.
Yeah.
I'm curious to ask the panel in general, what do you think the tannin level, forget the other grapes, what do you think the tannin level of Zin, what's the classic tannin level for Zin? I mean, I have my opinion, but I'm obviously not a producer. So either Kim or Aaron, what should a Zinfandel tannin, what should we expect from tannins? Or does tannin come from oak and Zin? Or is it a...
Well, I expect moderate tannins.
Yes.
I don't want highly tannic Zinfandel. That's just not good, in my humble opinion. Yes, you get a little oak tannin, certainly depending on the amount of aging, but I think overall we're looking for moderate tannins, you know, for a nice balanced structure, but allow the acidity and more, and most importantly, the beautiful fruit and beautiful spice tones to come through all harmoniously.
I would agree with that. I sometimes get tannins from like buyer's oil or more important like Litton, but I feel like they're so well balanced with the concentration of the wine, and that makes them so age-worthy. And I've had so many great zins from you guys that older vintages and
Ridge and dry grapes should do like an ageability
I was I wanted to add that yes, because you start to see that now we've already explored how different zin can be in the lighter cell, the fuller cell, the more blue fruits and more raisinated. But when you see zin age, it's incredible. I mean, I keep saying I just think zin is like in a way like natural. It just gets better and better as it ages. So, and do you have any comments on
Zin itself, 100% Zinfandel wine, is almost seamless in texture. Yeah. It's not a big tan grain, right? It's thin skinned, it's big berry. That's why petite straw is the end of the yang of Zin. So you've got petite straw, the exact opposite, small berries, all muscle, massive tannin, unruly, if you will. So, you know, a lot of just like the dial and mouthfeel or texture, give it layers by using blenders. Because Zin itself is just this unbelievably seamless wine. And we make 100% Zins, we want that seamless texture. And when we make Zin that's from multiple sites, or we're blending, so I'm not going to say we're reducing the effect of the terroir, but we're combining great sites that have terroir, making more food-friendly, user-friendly, multi-dimensional wine. Then we use petite syrahs, roll to go, things like that, to build mouthfeel and layers that way. But Zin on its own, pretty darn light and tan. Coming from a Bordeaux perspective, or you know, it's just almost non-existent. It should be less seamless.
Can you tell us about Wallace versus Beeson?
Yeah.
A little bit more about those sites?
Absolutely. So these are both estate-driven wines. And so the Wallace Ranch, obviously, well, maybe not obvious. My last name is Wallace. and my husband and I bought our property, which was the 12-acre vineyard, and it's directly behind the winery, adjacent to the winery, in 1990. And it was actually planted to Zinfandel, the old Davis clone, so kind of high-yielding, not particularly exciting Zinfandel, and we immediately tore it out. And what's really, this is a really special site. So let me just back up. One of the things in our region, Draper Valley, and having grown up there, one of the things we started to get very worried about in the late 80s, early 90s, was that we were losing a lot of these great, historic, old-vine Zinfandel vineyards, either to disease, but more frequently to people who were moving into the area and buying vineyards and then tearing them out to plant higher yielding, higher, more profitable wines like or grapes like Cabernet. And we started to see the demise of many great old Zinfandel vineyards. There was an amazing vineyard called the Ridge Wagon Ranch that we made Zinfandel from for years, and you know, somebody came in and tore it out and planted caps. So, my husband and actually our assistant winemaker at the time and our vineyard manager began a technique that was very innovative at the time, and it was called the heritage clone propagation technique. And this, let me just explain it because it's really important. What we did was they went into a very old pre-prohibition vineyard, actually the Mazzoni Ranch in Geyserville, and took the canes or the budwood over off the, you know, cuttings off, and over the series of years, grafted those onto rootstock that was eventually planted in our vineyard right in front of my house. And that propagation technique, if you will, where you're trying, you know, what we were trying to do is capture sort of the DNA or really the legacy of the old Mazzoni Ranch Zinfandel in a younger, newer planting. And of course, at the time, and this has now been 25 years ago, everybody thought young Zinfandel vineyards and young vineyards in general weren't as good as old vineyards. So this heritage clone propagation technique, and we actually called the wine heritage clone for a while, and then we changed the name to heritage vine because the word clone was getting a bad rap because of all the sheep cloning. Remember that years ago in England? Anyway, that propagation technique was used to develop this vineyard. So we've got the kind of the connection or the DNA to the old vines in a newer Zinfandel planting. And what we found at the time, now this is, you know, 2016 vintage, our first vintage was 1997. We found that the wine had these beautiful raspberry fruit tones, a little bit of boysenberry, and some lovely spice tones, and it was very exciting for us. And we have since used that propagation technique to develop some other estate vineyards, and now it's a fairly widely adopted technique in viticulture in our region, so it's not just us that did it. But that's kind of how the origins of this vineyard got started. So having said that, I think that, you know, that in itself, it makes it somewhat legendary in the sense that we really, it's a case study in trying to preserve old vine vineyards. You'll notice immediately that this is a wine that's, you know, much more sort of refined and a little bit softer and maybe a little more feminine than the Creason Ranch. For me, I get just beautiful fruit tones, almost like a sweet marzipan kind of sweet almond on the arrow, you know, very perfumed nose, nice balance, a little bit of a chocolate cherry, you know, kind of maybe flavor, and but just kind of refined structure. I don't like to use the word light, but of the two, this is the lighter of the two, and I think you can see it just looking under glass. It would make sense. Part of it is it's a 25-year-old vineyard, and this is a 125-year-old vineyard. Yeah, decent. So, yeah, so that's the Wallace Ranch. Very, very limited production. It's up on the Fitch in the middle of Dry Creek Valley, right, as I said, it's right where I live, right near the winery. So I think that's, oh, and the other thing I was going to say about the Wallace Ranch, which is interesting, is my winemaker, Tim Bell, actually, for the barrel aging, designed a specific barrel that he called a fusion barrel, which is it's kind of an innovative concept where we basically take the heads are French oak and then the staves are a combination of European oak, so Hungarian, Yugoslavian, and so hence a fusion of different oak species. And so we did that because we wanted very soft, we didn't want a, you know, intense oak or strong oak to overpower the delicacy of Zinfandel fruit. So that's the type of age, and it's aged for about 19 months. So if you juxtapose that with the Beeson Ranch, now this is, we were talking earlier about old wines, but this vineyard, oh my gosh, you guys, it's amazing. It was planted in the 1890s, so like David said, you know, the beauty of these historic vineyards is, think about it, they were planted with a horse and plow, right? You know, they survived all the, you know, all the wars and the 1906 earthquake and all these things that have, you know, happened in our culture or in California. When I go into this vineyard, I literally get goosebumps. The vines are maybe 2 feet tall. It's spotty. I mean, they're, you know, we try to replace vines and we do replace vines, but it's kind of spotty. The vines are actually completely hollow. When my husband first came to work for my dad in the early 1990, he was our ranch manager. And I remember Don came home one day and he said, I won't believe what I saw. Well, I couldn't figure out why all that they were, the field workers were in there doing something, probably leafing or I don't know, something. And I couldn't figure out why they were kicking the vines. And every time they would go up to a vine to start their work, they would kick it and they'd stand there and stare at the vine. And he like observed these guys doing it for about an hour. Well, it turns out that in the summer months, so the vines are completely hollow. You know, they're so old, they're completely hollow. In the summer months, the rattlesnakes come out of the hills and they slither up inside to not only stay cool, but to feed on mice that are in there hiding. And so that's our story about Creason Ranch. If you ever go there, you've got to be careful. But anyway, so as he said, it's a field blend. I don't even know what the varieties are in there. We've got it now, but I sort of forgot it. But you're going to notice, and this is just, you know, we try at my winery, we really try to make wines that have kind of taste of place. And this is a vineyard that repeatedly, year after year after year, we're talking about decades and decades and decades, always has this very distinctive spice tone. Sometimes it's like a minty white pepper, sometimes even like a little bit of, you know, the aroma of patchouli oil?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, a little bit of that. You know, this very exotic spice tone. You get definitely more of a deeper, more brooding, darker fruit, you know, more plum, blackberry, boysenberry, kind of feel, fruit intensity, maybe even a little bit of a mocha characteristic. So I think probably maybe some would say more complex than the first wine, but just different. And, you know, again, speaking to the alcohol, it's 14.5%. So here's an example of, you know, very complex, I think, some of the old style Zinfandel, but the alcohol's in check. And there's good acidity, and it's definitely age-worthy. You know, sadly, a vineyard like this, I mean, we get, so it's head prone, right? No trellising system. The vines just grow and it's just like a shake of the goblet. All dry farm. You think about 125 years, all dry farm. It's amazing. But the vines are very, very, very low yield. We get maybe a half a ton or a ton per acre. We get maybe three and a half, 4 tons maybe on the Wallace Ranch. But it's a very expensive wine for us to make. And so one of the really sad things, and it really made me happy to hear you say, Aaron, that, you know, even, you know, a winery like Gallo, right, that they really recognize that it's not about profitability. I mean, anybody who came along and bought this vineyard today who was a finance person would rip it out immediately. And this is what the tragedy is of fantastic Zinfandel vineyards in California is, because they are low yielding and they're, you know, they're not profitable. I mean, it's a labor of love when we produce wines from these types of vineyards, and it's one of the reasons why I'm so pleased that you're all here, because I think it's terribly important for people in your position to really celebrate these heirloom vineyards and you know, showcase them to your customers, because we don't want to end up in a world where these kinds of vineyards are all gone, right? And, you know, people are only farming for profit. That would be just a tragedy. So I guess I'll get off my soapbox on that. But you can tell I'm really passionate about not only Zinfandel, but these particular sites. And just the Dry Creek Valley. One thing I wanted to just share about Dry Creek Valley, in case you haven't been there. So it's a small region, 16 miles long, about half a mile to maybe a mile at the widest point. And it's a very diverse little region. We have the hillsides and mountains, kind of hillsides and benchlands, and sort of northern end of Dry Creek Valley. It's quite steep. And then, of course, you have the valley floor where we grow Sauvignon Blanc. But one of the things that's really unique about our region is the fog influence. So while Dry Creek Valley, some would say, is maybe a warmer, not really a warm, it's not as warm as Alexander Valley, certainly not as warm as Napa, but it's a warm planet. But it's very much affected by the Pacific Ocean and that fog or marine layer that comes in every day in the summer and cools the grapes down. So we'll have maybe a 35 degree shift in temperature every day in the summer. It'll be cold and foggy at night, you know, 55 degrees. And then it'll get up into the 80s, 90s, and it can sometimes surpass 100 degrees in the day. But, you know, it's cold and foggy in the morning. And then 11 o'clock rolls around, and you've got to take your jacket off, and then it's hot and summery. So that's what makes Dry Creek Valley such a unique region to grow grapes, is you know, we get that nice, long, slow maturation period for the grapes to ripen, and the cooling effect that we all absolutely loves. And so it's how we also prevent the Zinfandels in our region from becoming too high in sugar and high alcohol.
Right. I really love the Wallace, and you see that peachy, like yogurt almost, like, mm-hmm. like you said, it's not light, but it's a little more feminine.
It's fine.
And then these, and you can really see the old vines and the structure and how concentrated the wines are. And as I think through, you know, we've said it a couple of times, but how these wines pair with food, I think it's really important when you slow cook something and you braise it and you condense it and you make it really intense in flavor. Sometimes with the older vines, I feel like that's a really perfect pairing. Like I was braising something all day long and I served it with Zin, and it has this freshness, mm-hmm. but at the same time it's concentrated. I think we need to think about that. One of my favorite pairings, I have a couple of them for Zin, but I love like your style of Zin when you just take a tomato at the peak of summer and you just cut the tomato open and leave it on your counter, and you almost, it's like becomes like a gazpacho. It's like sweet, at peak sweetness, but so fresh in acidity and just amazing. But I also love the idea of some of like your style of Dry Creek when you're making like bolognese and you have like a ragu, beef, pork, veal, whatever, concentrating this tomato, and you get like this intensity, but still it's fresh. So I love tomato-based anything, ketchup and rubbers.
And I mean, I think this is a really important thing, you know, when you make the barbecue sauce and then you start with that sweet and sour, tangy, all of these unripe and ripe flavors. So then
anything pork.
Yes.
Anything tomato-based.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of wines that can say that.
That's true.
Yeah.
In fact, the Cabernet isn't
not
really
good
with that.
Not good. It's not with tomato sauce or tomato-based dishes at all.
And it makes sense. Italian-American food, right?
Yes.
It's Italian-American grape.
And now, a word from our sponsor. Exploring the Wine Glass is brought to you by Dracena Wines. Dracena Wines is an artisan winery located in Paso Robles, California. They have been producing wine since 2013. Their first vintage began with one wine, their classic Cabernet Franc, which received a 91 in Wine Enthusiast. Since then, they have increased production, received several accolades, including double gold medals in the San Francisco Chronicle Wine Competition, and consistent 90-plus ratings. In addition to their classic Cabernet Franc, they now produce a single vineyard, single clone reserve Cabernet Franc, and a rosé of Syrah. Although they've increased production every year, they continue to sell out each vintage. Find out more about Dracena Wines and their award-winning wines at DracenaWines.com, and let them help turn your moments into great memories.
So I don't want to rush us along, but I'm mindful of the time, and I think what we can do maybe is have Aaron talk about wines 7 and 8, because those are two of the wines that you represent, and we'll taste along with you, and then I'll talk about the other wines when the time comes, but I'm going to talk about like this 126-year-old vineyard, right, and how it looks, how it farms, or how the wines showcase in your community. Don't tell them anything about the concentration yet. I'm curious if
they... Right. I'll just say a little bit about the block itself. Interestingly enough, our group called it the Crafty Bubble on here. We call it the Browsing Block. Those little buggers are in here as well. It's a good hiding spot for rattlesnakes for sure. Just tell you a little bit about Monte Rosso itself. Is sort of southeast facing. It ranges from about 850 all the way up to 1,300 feet, so we do sit above the fog layer on a light fog day. Fog ceilings typically run about 1,000 feet on a light fog day where it moves out quickly. On a heavy day where the fog hangs out till about noon, that ceiling can be upwards of 12, 13, 1,400 feet. We'll be just you know, kind of sitting in it for a while, but really neat spot on the north end of the Sonoma Valley. It's where the valley gets actually kind of narrows down to about a half mile almost, which then reminds me of the same with where we are in the Dry Creek Valley. They both have that sort of same perspective where the cool air can rush in and out, but that warm air during the day, the hot air, it's almost trapped, and it just sits there, and it's nice. The Zin needs kind of like this convection of sight, and it's really deep. That warm air just sits there, and on a nice hot day, the winds will come to the rescue and cool it off, and it's a fantastic site. We have tremendous age. We have very red, hence the name Monte Rosso. We have very red volcanic soil. As David mentioned, what's interesting is we've heard, I think now, several times the importance of acidity. So we too do not add acid to the Monte Rosso wine. In fact, one of the things that we have to wait for is for that acidity to kind of reduce a little bit, because it has a tartness and edginess. And once that softens up, that's one of our big indicators. So in addition to flavor, we're looking for that acidity to start to soften up a bit. Most people look like they've tasted it. So I think when you've gone over the top, you're no longer expressing terroir, you're in the raisin molasses mode, right? And those are those big, just hedonistic, crazy high alcohol ones. With this one, we actually have quite high acidity, very high acidity, in fact. Some good energy to the wine, good lift. And for us, there's still that sort of kind of a little Chinese fire spice. There's kind of that spiciness to it, for sure. We do have an oak play with this wine as well that lifts that spiciness, but we're looking for, again, that seamless texture. It almost is just super velvety. And somebody had to do it. This wine is 16.2 alcohol. we're happy that, you know, a lot of the berries that have that good acid and have that good energy, they kind of showcase the place. And if you don't notice a burn or Monterosa, these little vines, they kind of struggle for dear life, and they're retaining that acidity to the best of their ability. They're trying not to dehydrate, so what happens is the whole cluster itself kind of gets this nice, generous little bit of dimpling and shrivel. And overall, when acids align with the sugars, it just happens to be that they're at, call it 28 at picking, and then by the time they soak up, they're down to 30. But what that hillside site, again, it's, we irrigate only in like heat spikes, preventative measures to keep them alive. They're largely dry farm. They're on a hillside, hardly any soil. It's not very rich soil, that's for sure. These things are struggling for dear life, and so they really do drag it out and try and hold on to that acidity, and that's apparent. Monterosa is a very special site, and that acidity and that spiciness is sort of a telltale signature of its regrouping. So Monterosa, the property is 550 acres. We have about 200 planted, and only about 43 is in. Again, it's been largely a Zin and Cabernet vineyard in the past. And we have the oldest block on the ranch is actually the Semillon. It's kind of fun. It's 134 years old, so really neat stuff. But for us, for this wine, is it obnoxious? Are we trying to be high over the top, high alcohol Zin? No, we're actually just doing what these old buggers want to do. And it's got generous fruit, it's got seamless texture. It's actually 70% new oak, 50% French, 20% American. It seems like a huge amount of oak. Again, doesn't come across as over oaked. It's not your loose grain, intense coconut, whiskey lactone kind of American oak. That French oak is to impart a little bit of some texture and layers, almost add that kind of sandalwood and some of those nice spicy characters to it. But this wine on paper, and analytically, my chemistry, looks like it has no restraint, right? This is a monster or a massive beast of a Zin. But when you taste it and you get all that flavor and texture and acid, I don't think it's, we think it's quite restrictive. It's just when you look at the numbers, it all looks crazy. So anyway, hopefully that's an example of some sites that just really get very, very ripe. But ripeness also means a good retention of acidity and flavor and personality.
The interesting thing about this one is like I almost want to take it to like Peking Duck House and just think about like this like fatty, rich, intense, but somehow even though you have Peking Duck, it still is intense in flavor, but somehow like refreshing, you know? So like hoisin sauce and those type of flavors. There's not a lot of wines we can really pair with that. Is how do you get light or how do you get intense flavor but still have some elegance? So I would love that, like five spice pinda, and it's a really beautiful wine, and it shows like power and also restraint. To me, sometimes these wines are interchangeable with like Amarone in this style, where you get a little bit of that dated fig. Think about Amarone; it's big like this, but somehow it has so much acid that it almost feels like the shape is like. Starts off big, but then narrows and becomes really elegant. And I think this is a wine that, while it doesn't have residual, maybe like the teeniest, but a little residual,
technically
dry. But you can carry it from, steakhouse wine, lettuce, all the way through, some dark chocolate. So it's really in between.
And this one's interesting from a food standpoint, or some of the tastings that I've done with it. There's a perception of, big wines, I don't like big wines that are dry. They're too dry. And people with this one say, this wine's got nice sweetness to it. Well, yeah, alcohol and some of the viscosity and sweetness to it. So we actually get that sweetness. We can get the wine 100% dry and yet still have all that sweetness from alcohol. So I think alcohol in balance is pretty impressive what you can get to. And I'm not, again, justifying.
This
wine is Bear Flies for us is a great sort of, we've been great at growing Zin. We have Zin, as it described, the Dry Creek Valley perfectly. So we're sort of on the eastern hill, more of the hillside, benchland as you slope down. It's called Fry Ranch. It's been there for a long, long, long time. We also have a ranch called Stefani, which Stefani is on a road and rides the ridge line that separates the Alexander Valley from the Dry Creek Valley. So this is kind of fun for you. Geography, a little nerd out moment here. We've got the Alexander Valley is really warm. Dry Creek is narrow, but it's still warm, but one layer, one valley closer to the ocean. And then I noticed later we're going to actually have a line from Leonard that's actually from the Russian River. So we get that real sort of bright cherry berry, because that's even cooler and closer to the ocean. And Zin definitely changes as you get closer to the ocean. Our Stefani Ranch rides that ridge of Alexander Valley and Dry Creek. So it tends to be weaker in soil, very generous and ripe, a little bit of Alexander Valley personality and a lot of Dry Creek personality as well. And these are some of our sites for Bear Flag. Bear Flag for us, it's an origin story. We think the epicenter is in Sonoma County in general, with Sonoma Valley, obviously our Monterosa site is important to us, and then the Dry Creek Valley being what I consider some of the epicenter is in. That's where we're located. So, this is our tribute to the origin of Zin, Bear Flag Revolt in the town of Sonoma. That's where I was born and raised. Kind of a fun little story and local feel to it. The Zinfandel was planted in Sonoma as well as Geyserville and Dry Creek. I think Sonoma is Zin. By personality, it is Zinfandel. And so Bear Flag is our little tribute to that. It's county because we combine multiple valleys. So Dry Creek Valley plus Sonoma Valley equals Sonoma County. On the label. We tried to find a sweet spot in terms of fruit, oak, texture, alcohol, all things considered. And this wine would be your food friendly, much more, not quite as personality, quite as stylized as the Monterosa is. A generosity of fruit, a little bit more apparent tannin here, and a little bit more grip. And that layer and texture is from actually Petit Sirah and Chirol de Gaulle. Those are two varieties that we also plant nearby. Try to use those just enough to push texture to where it's got some layers there and some density, but still be sort of real reminiscent of Zin, more of that seamless texture. And a little color as well. We call it a color blender. I think we use Petit Sirah as more of a texture blender. Chirol de Gaulle is certainly a color blender. And when people look at Zins, it's a whole a myriad of a spectrum. I think people look at this and go, oh, it's got beautiful color, nice ruby color. And the color blenders help out a lot in that case. There's 11% of them in this. So that's 89% Zin, 7% deep, and 4% Chirol de Gaulle. Other than that, we've been growing grapes and growing really good Zin for a long time, but the brands that we've been working on in some of our vehicles have just kind of floundered. And we tried to resurrect this Zin origin story, and in 2015 was our first vintage of Bear Flag. So this is the second. We're off and running. Both 15 and 16 were great Zin vintages. I think that's another thing. We need a little plug for the variety of Zinfandel. I don't lose sleep over Zin in the vineyard. I lose sleep over Zin in the fermenter. It requires like a new perspective every day of looking what's in the tank. Your sugars change, your acids change, your alcohol as it ferments. It's just unpredictable and changing every day. So those more dehydrated berries soak up. So it's a challenge, definitely a challenge. I lose sleep every year with Cabernet because Cabernet is so late ripening that we tend to pick a big slug right before the rain's coming. And it's like winter's coming, right? We know this rain is coming, it's going to hit us, and whether it's late October, early November if we're lucky, but we've got so much of that Cabernet worry at the end of the season, it's late ripener. Zin is a sort of mid-season ripener. If you pull the trigger early, you can get it late August, early September, and it's not uncommon to be done before the first week of October. So that, there's comfort in knowing that I don't think you have to look at the shelf and go, oh, 15 was a tough year, or 17 was a bad year. With Zin, I think we're almost exempt from those. It would have to be a tragic year to be really bad for Zin. And the fact that a lunch, especially David brought a 2011 Ridge, which 2011 is a vintage that I'd love to forget. Have PTSD for the rest of my life. That Zin was phenomenal, and it still showed fruit, and it still showed energy. And you can live past some early rains, but it's kind of a whole different ball game. So Zin is, it's in a great spot, and that's really what you think about what should be in the site. But you know, Cabernet is kind of the big bucks game, big giant red blend, popular worldwide. But it's Zin wants to be in Brackford. Zin wants to be in Alexander Valley. Zin wants to be in Sonoma Valley.
And Yolo.
For that, and Yolo County, absolutely, Yolo County. And for that, it's quality and it's wonderful to work with. It's great.
So great. I'm going to give you guys a couple of minutes to try through the wines, but I'm going to tell you about them as we taste, and then we'll have some, if you have any questions. I'm curious for the panel to think about soil types and how much that matters in Zinfandel. Maybe they'll comment on that in a second. Just because I'm curious about it, you know, what's the best soils or soil type or soils for Zin. But I'll just tell you about wine number 9. So this is Segezio. It's synonymous with Zinfandel, the family, the Segezio family. They came to the Alexander Valley in 1895. So Eduardo Segezio is originally from Piedmont, from Dogliani, the capital. And this is about a 56-acre vineyard plot in Alexander Valley called their home ranch. Andy Robinson is the winemaker. He was a winemaker at Charles Krug. And I really love the Segezio wines. I do some wine selecting for a company called, Wine Till Sold Out, but that's a parent company, but it's called The Weekly Tasting. And I find the Segezio wines are just like, approachable. A lot of our clients are just getting started in wine and like the juicier styles. This particular ranch is a clay and loam volcanic rock, low nutrient soil, which is really good for Zin to have more concentrated flavors. And so for me, this is 15.3 alcohol. I don't think you taste smell it at all. To me, this is a hedonistic but savory, earthy, old world style of Zin, at least in this glass. So when I was tasting it, I was, you know, just like, yeah, it has a richness of texture, but it has almost like an earthier aroma, savory, right? Yeah, so like sometimes, and I love savory green styles of Zin as much as I like the yogurt, the fig, the dates. So to me, this is more of that like primitivo or even like the Croatian.
More rustic.
Yeah, more rustic. Yeah, so like you guys are, we would talk about primitivo, but you know, like the parent grape for primitivo, or the idea is that it came from Croatia, from the Tripodav or Celiac Castellanski, and so at any point you guys would talk about that. But if for me, when I taste the Segezio home ranch, I always think about those like the Croatian, you know, like Slavat, Smalley, like they kind of have like almost like a irony, sea spray, nori kind of smell that really is quite nice, I think. Any other comments about Segezio? It's really good, right? And that's the thing. I mean, when you think about the great grapes in the world, you think about the idea that they are so different from producer to producer, site to site. I mean, I think we absolutely need to keep Zin in that the greatest wines of the world express different flavors depending on the soil, the land, the site, and the producer, of course. Okay, so that is Alexander Valley Segezio. And then number 10, as we already mentioned, is the Russian River. So this is a relatively new producer of wine called Leonard Wine Company. They are father and son team from St. Louis. Leonard made wine at Chiretto, Spotswood, Joseph Phelps, or had like some mentorship from there. And their style, if you will, is avoiding the high ripeness. They pick really early, they do cluster sorting, they de-stem, berry sorting, so anything that's raisins they avoid. And for me, this is an example that I felt like you could taste that uneven ripening, even though they sort. You do get that stewed and sour, some of that kind of like, the wine itself is just, like, there's a juxtaposition of the wine itself where you feel like when you first taste it, you get the like intensity, and then you get the sour, refreshing acidity. I don't know if anyone else has any thoughts or comments or
really
notes.
Like
it's really,
yeah,
really pretty.
It's really typical of Russian pepper. You know, it's at that Pinot Noir style, you know,
right?
A lighter green, really great red fruits, really attractive nose, little soft strawberry, really nice on the palate. And a lot of these old line vineyards in Russian River are threatened by Pinot Noir, right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of being pulled out and being replanted in an Alexandra Valley, and Cabernet that threatens the old line vineyard. So we're kind of getting threats in different directions depending on the appellation and what's happening in that particular appellation. But you know, we make that at Russian River in Tomato that has my life to really similar to this. Really
I always joke that my friends will probably kill me for saying this, and I don't really care, but I say the only Pinot Noir I like is the one that tastes like gin. Everyone like thinks it's the sophisticated, elegant, like, you know wine when you're drinking Pinot Noir. But for me, I really enjoy these, like, zins that have this. This is definitely tricky for a blonde tasting. If you're tasting zin like this, you know, we have blind tasting happy hour here from 4 to 6 daily, and I probably would never put this wine in a blind tasting, and for, like, people that were taking an exam, because I think you would think this was a good wine.
They would never.
Yes, it's so bright and perfumed.
Yeah, this is 2014.
Exactly.
To be honest, it's an amazing brightness. Give away my age. My sister had those little strawberry shortcake dolls with the hair in them. It was like that almost intense strawberry. And this one is so much vibrant strawberry too. It's 2014, so
yeah,
great.
I got almost like a strawberry Jolly Rancher.
Yeah.
You know, that Jolly, because to me it's very tart and very, you know, strawberry Jolly Rancher. So there's like, I guess that's the juxtaposition you're talking about.
Yeah. I had those strawberry shortcake figurines as well. Circle porcupine figurines, that guy. I remember because my grandpa got me like this little strawberry shortcake streamer, like beach cruiser, and I thought it was like, the coolest person ever. And so again, you see this like starting off like tart, acidity, cherry. You have some fade qualities. We have some yogurty, apricot. I remember Lisa Gronick, who's an MW and a really great mentor of mine, and we were first doing blind tasting. She had, of course, master of wine way of thinking, and she said you often get like white fruit or stone fruit in zin, especially from cooler sites, and you have to remember that apricot, peaches, you know, that really like beautiful cherry, white cherry, you know. So I'm glad we can show that as well. So next up is wine number 11. It's Peachy Cannon, Casa Robles. Planted in 1988, Nancy and Doug, the founders of the estate, had a 500-case winery. This is a single vineyard estate from Zinfandel plot, which is called Mustard Springs, and four different zones of Zin. It's between two, in Paso, this is actually an area where you have some of the vineyards north south facing, and half of them, and then half of them are east-west facing, so it's between two hills, so you kind of get a little bit more of a cooler part of Paso. And I think you can see this, to me, when I tasted it last night, it was like savory and green. You know how it's showing at the moment, but we often think still, we're like in Paso, it would be big and rich and intense, but I think because it is different, the way that the vine space, you get some of that. Yeah, sweet and sour. Tangerine, yeah. There's definitely citrus, right? To me, this was wild. So
yeah, there's some cool canyons in Paso, some areas that are definitely a little cooler. This has that, I get that was that marmalade we mentioned, neighbor kind of character. There's such a unique spectrum to this one. It's very different. The green, I would say for us, if we're going to embrace speaking on behalf of those in the really north, being a business central coast, but in the North Bay, any green that we would get, you've often heard the term bramble, like that blackberry thicket, kind of that character, that's real reminiscent of the greens that we would get, and sometimes that takes a while to shake off, and if it's there, it's fine. It's not vegetative or green or off-putting, it's just this unique bramble character. This is striking. We've got more than bramble and all that going on.
Yeah, I often think too, like, maybe it was Robert that asked us when we were putting a menu together for them, we're just like dreaming up like grapes and pairings. I feel like it, sometimes, you know, when you cook braised greens, like if you do like either spinach or you do like there's this Cabo like a black kale salad where a friend of ours at Lupa, they put like bacon on the salad and it's like this warm bacon. I feel like Zin's also really good with that, you know, lentils, bacon, like just, I mean, you can also, of course, have vegetarian food. Also, it's like one of those things where if you have good concentrated grilled veggies and Zin, it's a really good pairing. And I think this is, there's very few wines that go well with vegetarian food for reds, and Cabernet Franc being one of them. And when you have Zin like this, it gets really nice pairing.
Soils. Are very calcium heavy compared to most other soils in California, and I always get this chalky sensation.
Well, that's
I think I missed that. Is the Peach Canyon 100% zinc filled?
It's four different clones of zinc, but all 100% zinc. Good question. And then last but not least, I'll just explain the Klein Cellars Meadow Brook Ranch, Tehama County. Who knows where Tehama County is? Nobody. Okay, good. So this is in the Southern Cascade Mountain Range. You're in the northern part of California. It's bisected by the Sacramento River. And it, I guess if you were to think about it, well, you know where Mendocino is? It's just north and east of Mendocino. So below, like, you know, Shasta, nobody probably does, or north of Glen County. So anyway, this is Klein Cellars 2014. To me, you got some of the qualities that you found in the Louis Martini, so some of the raisinated, like a little teeny bit of date and intense, you know, it's a little bit further inland, so you get some of those drowning qualities, but.
I miss all the math. There might be a little ants on the map, or a little, you know, a line drawn to a different square. It's so far up, it's so far north. California's interior is like rice country, kind of near Chico, and very agricultural, but not many grapes. So very neat.
And then maybe we'll answer that question about soil. Like, what is Zin, in your opinion? I mean, I'm sure there's different, right?
Yeah, no, that's a great question.
I'll go for it.
So just speaking for Dragon Peak Valley, and that's our, you know, that's we're the flagship, in home of the namesake of the region, so I can only speak to that area, but. So Vizcondel and Dry Creek Valley is definitely impacted or, I guess, defined by the soils. And so on the western slopes of the valley, so that's where Beeston Ridge is, we have very high iron content. The soil is very red. And, you know, visually, it's bright red. And we, of course, grow Bordeaux varietals there as well. But Zinfandel just seems to really flourish. And so it's also on the hill, so a little higher elevation. Not super, super steep. But we get that high iron content on the west. And then on the eastern side, sort of on the benchlands, we have more of a decomposing sedimentary rock, so it's kind of more of a fluffier, rocky soil, maybe not fertile at all, you know, thinner, rockier soil. And so that's where this the Wallace Ranch is, and certainly the Linton Springs, too, where David's wine was from. And we have vineyards out in that area as well. So I think, you know, for me anyway, it's hard for me to say whether it's the age of the vines that creates the depth and intensity and how much is the soil. However, I'd like to think that the higher iron content definitely creates more intensity, more depth, because we see it in our Bordeaux varietals as well. Cabernet on the western side of Dry Creek Valley has like really, you know, intense cherry tones, and on the eastern side, it's a little different. So that's just, I guess, my perspective on Dry Creek Valley.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, whether it's that irony because the sites, the name of that soil type that we have some interest in, that Zinfandel loves that. It loves that clay loam, which is more typical also that you see throughout Dry Creek. What it doesn't like, we find, is that there are certain areas in Dry Creek, particularly up against the hillsides in the Alexander Valley, and that's where the Zin really does not do well. So you have to be careful with that. But what does well there is petite straw. So if you're careful about what you plant where, you can sort of work around that. And then it doesn't like wet feet at all, the Zinfandel. So as you get closer to the Russian River and the soils get heavier and jammer, that the Zinfandel's not happy there and will not work well in that.
And the other
thing,
we also have a lot of iron in our soil, but what I love about that area is, I keep mentioning we're in the coastal range. The coastal range is a mountain range that's still building, and there's also this fault there. So we have metamorphic, we have igneous, we have sedimentary rock, the two. So what I like about that is I figure that's just going to add to the complexity to the grapes that are growing on that site. The two main soil types that we have in the Primitivo block, about 10 acres, is corny gravelly loam and something called Poicitas clay. So the clay has the iron content, and we're at a little bit of elevation because it's over in the rolling hills, so it's really well drained. So my impression is you have the clay because you have some big cracks and stuff that I can see in the block, but then on top of that is this alluvial fan. This ancient alluvial sand. So we have boulders like this big throughout the block. So I don't know if this is true, but I believe that adds to some minerality in the wine that I get more. So there's that block, and we have a great block that has a lot of those big boulders. And I just get this savory, layered component that I don't get in the other more sedimentary, dominant soil type block.
I agree with, I think there's a better definition of where it is just nasty. David said that really, really well. When you breeze, when you wind, all this, everybody's discussing coastal and this effect, whether it's environmental shift in temperature, morning to night, assisted by ocean, but that's why wine country is wine country. That's where we're situated, the proximity of the ocean and the air, so it's all climate, all earth. It's a lovely location for it. Oddly enough, I have a little... Zin does great where chili peppers get the hottest, which is fun. So our vineyard crew, everywhere we have, always has a little garden nearby, almost every vineyard site. And the chilies off Monterosa are new there. And the chilies on Stefani in the good year are just super hot. So it's funny to have an indicator of sort of other plants. And to me, you can just tell a great vintage. And the right climate, when the chilies are thriving, they look good, and at the end of the season, they're so hot, it's like getting my blood to touch them.
And that's quite interesting, too, because like, when you think about high, spicy food, you almost always want to avoid alcohol if you don't like spice, but I would imagine that there's a significant amount of people that love the heat and spice, and the spicier the better, so the more high alcohol wines.
Yeah, our tolerance for spicy food is sky high. Nothing based on us, so.
I guess to close out, because we're a couple minutes later than I intended, we'll ask you a couple of questions, but I wanted to thank you all for your time. I know you're all busy. On behalf of staff, I would say, we should drink more Zinfandel. We should be more advocates for Zinfandel because it is one of the great wines that makes California what it is, which you said so perfectly in the beginning, the American dream. Just to come here and do the gold rush and have these vines that we thought were native, but turns out they're from our great-great-grandparents that brought them over. So really is amazing about California Zinfandel. It should be bought together. So we would hate to see some of these vines being ripped up just to make a profit. It's like the return in really to like these native grapes. And it's really important that we keep these grape sites alive so that we understand how different these wines can be and express for sure. So, all right, thank you so much. Have a great day.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, sláinte!